Welcome. We're now beginning the study session of the program, and this is the first in the series of the main course, so-called the main course. A very clever name for it. I wanted to say a little bit about the study altogether before we launch in, and I know people come from different backgrounds. Some people are very scholarly, and they love to study, love to read. Other people don't like it so much. Sometimes people had traumatic experiences in our educational system or have difficulty reading. So I just wanted to kind of remind you that this is not like a university course, and that nobody's being graded. And the point of the study is for your own benefit. In talking about seminary programs and study of Dharma in general, the Vijayadhara talked about practice and study as being like the two wings of an airplane, that we need both of them. He talked about the extremes of being arrogant intellectual with a conceptual understanding, but no heart understanding, no transformational understanding. And he also talked about the other extreme of being a stupid practitioner who doesn't know anything about tradition they're practicing. And he said, well, to be a good Dharma student, you have to join study and practice. And I think what links the two of them together so beautifully is interest and a curiosity, inquisitive state of mind, which the Vijayadhara manifested to the extreme, taking a real interest in your world, in your inner world, your inner experience, your outer world, your work, relationships, all of life. And that will go a long way in terms of practice and study. And the other thing that emphasized in studying the Dharma is that you're not exactly looking for answers. He much preferred the quality of question. In fact, there was one of these kind of phrases that's maybe said too much was he talked about the question being the answer. So that's something to think about, questioning. Anything you hear, you should question and test it with your own experience and your own understanding. Is it true? Does it make sense? Is it worth exploring? Questioning is it is like hammering a raw chunk of ore, hammering it and letting the gold be worked out. In some ways you're working with what you hear and you're extracting the essence, extracting the gold. So I just want to encourage you to enjoy the study part. And we've put into the schedule a period for reading, so you have time to read and enjoy this Profound Treasury Volume 1 that we're working with. So I also want to say a couple other little housekeeping things, and that is we're using all these terms. Chogyam Trungpa is the name of the founder of the Shambhala lineage, which is now headed by his son and successor, Sakyan Mipam Rinpoche. But he's referred to sometimes by the term of Rinpoche, which just means precious one. It's similar to in the Christian tradition saying reverend, like that. It's also often referred to as a Vijayadhara, which means the holder of knowledge. Vijaya means knowledge, Dhara means holder. So I'll be using all of those terms. Usually Vijayadhara is the most common, so whenever I do that, refers to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Okay, so now onward. I thought it'd be useful in beginning this course to talk about the context a little bit, the context out of which all these teachings seem to arise, and a little bit about how the whole book is structured. I'm trying to provide ways to help you get the most benefit from studying and reading this kind of material. So I thought, well, what's the context overall? Where does it come from? And I thought, well, it comes from non-duality, which is the center figure on the shrine, the Vajradhara non-duality, non-dual wisdom. That's the ultimate context from which this all arises. And the challenge all along with the people presenting the Dharma is how to awaken non-dual wisdom through dualistic methods, through words, through gestures, through forms and rituals. How can all of those kind of dualistic methods point one to non-dualistic understanding? So there's another very common kind of a traditional image that I think is useful even in reading something like this or working with a practice or relating to the shrine, etc., is that don't mistake the finger for the moon. They say they're pointing at the moon when you're a little child and they do that and they look at your finger. That's what the word moon means? These are all pointers. These are all pointers. This is kind of like a laser beam. Laser beam to the moon. But don't mistake the laser beam for the moon itself. These are just tools. They're just tools to awaken your understanding, awaken your heart, awaken your mind, give you a more fulfilled, peaceful life. So that was the general overall context. Then within that, obviously the context is the whole world of Vajrayana Buddhism, and particularly Tibetan Buddhism, and the lineages and traditions from which the Vajradhara arose or was discovered within, and within which he was thoroughly trained in the old style within Tibet. In particular, as was mentioned in Chris's introduction to who's who on the shrine, there were two main schools of teaching that the Rinpoche or Vajrayana referred to over and over again as his heart traditions. One of them is the Kagyu tradition, which is the also referred to as a practice lineage. And the other is a Nyingma tradition, the ancient tradition, another practice lineage. He had key teachers in both of those lineages, although he's recognized as a Kagyu Tulku or reincarnate Lama. But more important in some ways than those two streams was the attitude with which he was steeped, and that is the attitude is called Rime, R-I-M-E, Rime, and that means non-biased, non-sectarian tradition. The attitude of Rime in Tibet was drawing from the richness and the practices of all the great teachers, no matter what tradition they were identified with. I think in the modern world, the attitude of Rime extends, you know, we're in a period of history where all the great traditions and non-traditions, spiritual and psychological, scientific, etc., are all jumbled together in interesting, creative ways. And I think the attitude of Rime is seeing teachings, respecting the teachings of the various schools and religions and psychologies, and also the sense of open-minded and looking and recognizing wisdom when you see it, in whichever form it is, not just in wrapped up in with a bow or wrapped up in a robe, but wherever you encounter it, having the attitude of a student. There's a saying, when a student is ready, a teacher will appear. And I think that can be taken in sometimes in a narrow sense, as though you sit there and say, I'll try to get ready, and you think some kind of glorious figure is going to come and just lay on teachings on you. Or it could have the quality of and your teacher is ready, when a student is ready, it's amazing you start seeing teaching everywhere. It is everywhere. That's part of the notion of sacred world. But we miss most of it, really. We just get into the grunts and groans of getting through our day and the recognition of opportunities for awakening that pop up everywhere are kind of lost in the complexities and preoccupations of our conceptual minds and our personal dramas and all that, you know. So that's another context. The next context for this work is really the encounter of Vijayadhara with Western culture, and particularly encountering in the case of North America, encountering in the early 70s, the culture of the 1970s, early 70s. And that kind of meeting point, there needs to be both students and teachers, you know, for Dharma to happen, you know. So that meeting point somehow made it possible for these incredible teachings to start to be available to Westerners. There are other pivotal kind of interesting encounters that led to the forms that we have here. Barry had mentioned Trungpa Rinpoche's encounter with the Zen tradition and how influential his friendships with great Zen teachers was in terms of talking about what is a skillful means of presenting Dharma in the West. We have a picture back there of that guy. is Shinryo Suzuki Roshi, who was connected with the San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara. So he had a close association with Trungpa Rinpoche, and it affected many forms. Like the group sitting that we do is very much from inspired by Zen practice. If you think about it, it's like making this incredible meal with all these ingredients. Another ingredient really was the monastic tradition within which Vijayadhara was trained. You know, his early training was as monastic. And in Tibet, they really liked the monastic tradition. They had tons of their children became monks or nuns. I mean, a huge proportion of the population became monks and nuns. And were trained to various levels within that particular system. A very old style, system within a spiritual hierarchy, I suppose you could say. And that monastic training went all the way back to the early days of the Buddhism. You know, originally, Buddha was just wandering around teaching in India, and people just went and followed along. The earliest form of monasticism, people cut their ties to their families and shaved their hair off and all dressed the same. And that was kind of the early beginnings of the monastic tradition in Buddhism. In early Buddhism, there were monastic people who did that. They just left everything. They didn't have regular jobs. They didn't marry and all that, have children. And there were lay people who supported the training and supported the monks and nuns and also received teachings in exchange for the offering of generosity. But there's a third type of practitioner, again, in terms of the origins of all this, that sometimes doesn't get mentioned as much, and that is the Mahasiddha tradition. And the Mahasiddha traditions were not monks, and they weren't lay people exactly either. They were this kind of blend, and there are all sorts of types of them. Some of them, you know, worked in equivalent like a factories, and some of them like criminals, and some of them, you know, musicians, or some of them just slept all the time. They had all sorts of different lifestyles, but they were completely dedicated to the Dharma and dedicated to practice, and were very realized beings. So, in looking at all of these, and there's many more kind of streams of influence that all came together magically, make it all this possible. There's another interesting stream, which was the invasion of Tibet by the Chinese. They would put it otherwise, because there's always two views to every story. But the oddly enough, we're the beneficiaries of that violent takeover of Tibet, because that led to the Tibetans needing to flee their homeland and become literal refugees, and in kind of somewhat parallel to some Jewish tradition, led to kind of a diaspora of Tibetans all over the world. And prior to that, there was kind of a very isolated quality in Tibet. If you were, you know, some kind of extremely brave explorer like Madame David Neal or something, you might kind of worm your way into Tibet and hear something about the Buddhism there. But for most people, it was a hidden away in the West. You know, it just wasn't available. So it's interesting how the different streams of this incredible positive energy of the cultivation of compassion and wisdom coming from the Tibetan and the Buddhist tradition altogether, and the forces of violence and just basic human historical stuff that happens, all converging, and as a result, Trungpa Rinpoche ended up in the West. And as a result, we were fortunate enough to be within this stream of teachings. You can imagine the change, you know, from a kind of a medieval culture isolated with a clear systems, clear hierarchies, and leaving that all behind, and having to start over literally at every level. You have nothing, you know, refugee camp. And in a culture that is so different. But we're going to talk about so Tarpa. But the culture is so different. Barry mentioned in talking about the sadhana of Mahamudra how there were some pivotal points in the Vijayadhara's life, and when he was pondering, well, you know, what to do with the weight of the cultural heritage and wisdom heritage that he held. How to convey that, you know, how to convey that in such different times, different culture, different situation altogether. And what he came upon as, he could have just set up as a lama somewhere with some students around and do the standard things, as, or make them all monks or nuns or whatever, and just do what he'd been trained to do within Tibet and just try to make that work. And he could have led a probably much easier life than dealing with the kind of people he ended up dealing with. But he didn't do that. He really did start beginning at the beginning, which is the theme of this talk, beginning at the beginning. He just cleared the slates. Cleared the slate and looked and let something new arise, what seemed to be skillful in these times and this culture. As he started gathering, students started gathering around him, he preferred not to talk about, he didn't emphasize monasticism, but he also didn't emphasize lay course, what he developed this term called householder yogi, householder yogi, which is somewhat related to that third wheel, so to speak, that Mahasiddha tradition. And I think he meant that it's not just some people do the tradition, other people, you know, give them food, but he said you can be in the world and totally dedicated to the practice altogether. So he presented practice for people that are engaged in this world, that are not escaping from the world or trying to go to some better place, or maybe we'd like to, but anyway, get putting back into where you want to go from. And so be kind of a professionals and skilled at daily life and skilled in practice and dedicated to the Dharma as householder yogis. I remember talking to him once about, you know, monastics and, you know, kind of the beauty of the monastic system, where you just enter a convent or you enter a monastery or whatnot, and you just, all you have to do is study and practice, and the bell rings, you do the next thing, the bell rings, you do the next thing, and it just sounded so great. So simple and so nice, you know, and you don't have to deal with, you know, like children and jobs and husbands and you know, IRS and, you know, the U.S. government and all that. He said, well, he talked fondly about the beauties of monastic training that he received, but he said, actually, this householder yogi path is much richer and is more provocative, and that's what you got to do. So that's what we're all trying to do. Although he did concede and start a small monastery at some point called Gampo Abbey. I guess it's a monastery. It's called an abbey. I don't know the difference, but it's the monastic side of what we do. I wanted to talk about the structure of the three volumes, in a way. This is just one of three volumes. And it is called The Path of Hinayana, Path of Individual Liberation. So this term, Hinayana, can be very confusing because often it refers to particular schools of Buddhism, you know, such as found in Sri Lanka and some other places, the Theravadan tradition. But in the context of these teachings, it refers to a stage of the path, not to a particular school of Buddhism. There's a tradition in the Vajrayana, or a Tibetan tradition, what's called Lam Rim, L-A-M-R-I-M, Lam Rim. And that means just simply stages of the path. Stages of the path. It took a very systematic approach to the Dharma, you know, try to provide a roadmap for students just to follow along from the very beginning to the very end, although there isn't an end, and it's more like a circle. And that was divided into three stages. Hinayana, or Tekpa Chung, means narrow vehicle. So yana is an important term to know, and it means vehicle, like a car or a bus or bicycle or, you know, feet. And yana is the image of a vehicle is that something you get in, it takes you somewhere, you know, you move, it's moving. And the quality of path is one of movement. Even though we practice being still, there's a movement, there's a sense of going somewhere at the same time. So stillness and movement. And there are various ways you can think about vehicles. But again, it's not so much taking on an ideology or a philosophy they're talking about, taking on something that will help you attain your destination. And, you know, just thinking about things won't help you attain your destination, but getting into a car will. So this is like meant to be applied through practice, applied through contemplation and study. Hina means the narrow. It's called the narrow vehicle, not in the sense of narrow-mindedness or lacking in some way, but in the sense of bare bones and precise and true and raw. No mathematics, nothing added or subtracted. Just immediate, clear, simple. It's considered the essential foundation for everything, for the entire path. Hinayana. The second of the three yanas is the Mahayana. Maha means great, and yana again means vehicle. So there's a sense of from gathering and settling and collecting, naturally there's an expansion, expanding out. And the Mahayana vehicle is all about that. Or another way of looking at it is at the beginning point, we have to work with our own shit. and we won't be much help to anyone. If we aren't willing to look into our own minds, our own hearts, our own regrets, our own plans, our hopes, our delusions, etc., our obstacles, we won't be much benefit. So it's very practical. That's one thing I like about the Dharma, it's so practical. And I said, okay, work with yourself, but work with yourself with the intention behind that, working with yourself, that you are preparing yourself to be able to contribute something to others. And you're preparing yourself so you're able to reduce the suffering in this world, the confusion in this world, and the kind of utter chaos in this world. That's the second of the three vehicles. The third is called the Vajrayana. Again, yana is vehicle, and vajra is adamantine, or I guess you call it diamond-like. Sometimes called the diamond path. It's also referred to as tantra. And that vehicle is it's called the indestructible vehicle. And it's based on diving wholeheartedly into the midst of phenomena in order to manifest the awakened state and to benefit others. So this is a each yana corresponds to one book. But within that, there are, you could say that the Vijayadhara goes through this progression from the very starting point. We're just looking at yourself and wondering, like, what's wrong, all the way up to the end. He goes through this path, joining. Hello. Joining two traditional maps, again, always bringing from the Nyingma tradition and the Kagyu tradition. The Nyingma nine yana tradition is spelled out in detail, and the Kagyu tradition of the Hinayana, Mahayana, and then the Mahamudra is also spelled out in detail, and he joins them together in his presentation. So that's a little bit about the structure. It really is a map, and it really is will lead you to your destination. So another kind of, I guess, key term or assumption or something like that in looking at all this might be helpful. We talked about the idea of a vehicle. And then where does vehicles have to go? How do vehicles go? Well, there's roads or paths. And So the notion of path is very important in Buddhism altogether. And that's talked about in various ways, the Noble Path, etc. But the notion is that there is that we are on a journey, that we have some intention of where we're going. There's some, it's not willy-nilly, there's a kind of intentionality, and that we're given directions. There are, you know, street signs and and things that kindly provided by the great teachers and those who have gone before us have created a path that others can follow. There's a story of Buddha after he attained awakening that, you know, he thought, well, I have no idea what to how to help other people realize what I realized. And so from the very early on, there was a notion of, well, we have to help people. You have to help provide a path that will help them to attain the same realization that I myself have realized. And that you could say a path is a, all of these are analogies, really, but a path, having the attitude of being on a path changes how we relate to our daily life. Having an attitude that we're just not getting through the day, but we're actually committed to some kind of path, and it has certain boundaries and disciplines, and it has a certain places our life in a kind of perspective. Not just our own path, but the entering kind of a stream of activity that connects us with people have many thousands of years have traversed this similar path, and in the future will do so as well. So we're kind of joining in a particular direction. You know, we're saying we're going to enter into a direction that kind of goes against the stream. You know, goes against a lot of the energy of what we confused reality, samsaric world, where it's just like get as much as you can for yourself and forget about everybody else, or etc. Materialistic outlook. So there's a vehicle, there's a path, and then there's the, you know, the rider, the person who gets in the vehicle, the individual. And particularly since it's a path of individual liberation, he says that's a soso tarpa, individual liberation. That's you. And there's a lot of kind of subtlety to the notion of individual. One is that that nobody else can do your path for you. It really is personal. And every one of you will do it differently. Everyone has done it differently within the constraints of the tradition altogether. And you can receive teachings, and you can have practices to do. And you can do all sorts of service and loop-de-loops. But none of that will save you. It all comes back to you yourself alone. The one of the readings during the sitting, Vidyadhara gave these examples of loneliness. Talked about playing a bamboo, the sound of a bamboo flute, or plucking a guitar beneath a waterfall. Remember that one? Plucking a guitar beneath a waterfall. Interesting image. Nobody can hear it. You couldn't hear a thing from a guitar being plucked under a waterfall. But it's very beautiful, the thought of just contentedly plucking your guitar that nobody can hear. There's the there's a good side and the bad side, I suppose, this notion of individual liberation. The good side is that one thing that the Hinayana teachings are trying to get across to us is that you are self-sufficient. You have what you need. You don't need anything imported. You have what you need. That the people who have traveled on the Buddhist path, they're not like saints or magical beings. They're ordinary humans, and ordinary humans who have bodies and emotions and mind, they have what they need. That's the good news. But how many people really feel you actually have what you need? When you're sitting on a cushion, you need nothing. But to actually feel that way, many people don't. Most of us feel we always need something. We're never good enough. We don't have enough. We're not smart enough. We're terrible practitioners. We're told our mind is crazy. We don't have enough. But in fact, the notion of individual salvation is you do have enough. So the bad news is that it's up to you, and that there's no there's no particular magic trick, and there's no particular savior that's going to help you. The Vidyadhara had seemed to take delight in from time to time saying things like, "It's up to you, sweetheart. It's up to you," and it is. The whole path is up to you. What you do with it is up to you. It is. That's individual liberation. So later on in the course, we'll talk more a little bit about egolessness. But first, you have to be individuals. You have to claim the individuality and acknowledge that. Each your own voice, each your own shape and size, each your own obstacles. But fortunately, within that, there's a lot of people who have more experience that can help you with that. And that is in the Hinayana tradition, the notion of an elder. So it's just a sense of, well, when you want to learn something, just ask a question of someone who's practiced a little bit more or studied a little bit more or might know it. And don't hesitate. Ask questions about everything. So the other side, there's soso and there's tarpa, the individual, and liberation. Or you could also translate that as freedom. So that's interesting to explore. What is that? You know, we're free. You know, we live in a free country. So what do we need? You know, the liberation, right? What is that? You know, if what kind of bondage are we talking about? You know, what do we need freedom from? What keeps us from being free? What is that notion? What is liberation? Liberation. Well, it seems that can be looked at in different ways, and it'd be well to explore that. Do you feel free already? Then you forget the whole thing. go home. That would be fine. I'm good for you. And well, one of the premises, one of the odd things in terms of freedom, at least from the Buddhist understanding, is that if we look around for who is imprisoning us, who is a slaveholder, you know, who's massa who, that's you. You are imprisoning yourself. That's, again, what could be a hopeful or unhopeful news, so to speak. Hopeful news is, well, if you are imprisoning yourself, you can liberate yourself, going back to the possibility of individual liberation. It's in your mind. It's how you're viewing yourself and your world. It's somehow askew, messed up. And because of that, you suffer a lot. So individual liberation. It's said that we're imprisoned by how we think about things, and we're imprisoned by our habits at every level, from mind ruts and habits, addictions of all kinds. And we're imprisoned because we can't control our emotions. They're like all over the place. So we can't control our thoughts or habits or emotions. And that's why I might as well just like lock the door and throw away the key. You know, that's our situation. So, and those are what we're actually working with. And you kept saying, who did that? Who's? You can't find anyone to blame. You can't find anyone to blame because it's us. Freedom. But there's good news is that we suspect, or we're shown, or we have the opportunity somehow in our life, something pops up in our mind or our experience, something pops up that makes us think we don't have to be like that. It could be anything. Some simple thing pops up in our mind. Vijaya once talked about, for instance, say you grow up in the middle of a big, huge slum, you know, and it, you know, that's your world, and you're in a big, huge slum, slumming around and, you know, mucking through the day, and you have no idea that there's anything other than the slum. So you're doing your best within your slum, and then somehow you get a glimpse that, you know, right outside, a couple blocks away, there's it's really a beautiful park, and you know, people that are have everything, right? So then you suddenly you're not so happy. It wasn't just like where you live. You think, well, how come all there's all that beautiful stuff out there, and I'm stuck here, right? So in terms of mental world, something pops up in your mind, and you think, I'm not really happy. The way things are going, and I know that my mind's not just a slum, but I have, you know, Park Avenue and, you know, all sorts of stuff in there, and central, you know, big forests and beautiful flowers. You know, there's other stuff there. So there's a bit of a longing to figure out how to get from point A to point B, so to speak. Again, path, journey, traveler. So I wanted to touch on a couple other key issues that might help with this volume. And in terms of how Vijayadara was presenting the Hinayana, he presented it in terms of three traditional categories called Shila, Samadhi, and Prajna in Sanskrit. And this is very traditional. He wanted the books to be as much as possible, you know, aligned with those qualities, which was possible up to extent, a certain extent. Shila means discipline. Sometimes it's translated as morality. It means behavior, I guess, is another way of looking at it. And it's everything from the forms you work with. It's the how you conduct yourself in your daily life. In particular, in the Hinayana path, the quality of Shila is characterized by a restraint of a certain kind. Restraint. Not just acting impulsively, whatever thought arises, and just not blurting out whatever, whatever comes to your mind. Or not just kind of you know, moving about kind of randomly, you know, but there's a kind of a sort of a dignity and restraint in your posture. There's a precision and respect for yourself, for the objects in your world, from the simplest things you do to the most transcendent or complex or whatever. There's taking an attitude of discipline. How you speak, how you move, how you think. Discipline, Shila. The second of the three, Samadhi, refers to meditation. Meditation practice. In this case, mindfulness and awareness. We'll talk more about that. But there's a sense of acting from a mindful attitude, paying attention, not just going through the motions. Sometimes I think, mindfulness, it's not like to sit, kind of walking on eggshells, try to keep track of everything, that kind of thing, or like a busybody world. But it's kind of a relaxed attentiveness, in how you go about things. Suzuki Roshi used the phrase readiness mind, which is great. You know, its mind is relaxed. It's not like caught up, but it's not asleep. It's tuned up, so it can respond nimbly to what arises, a readiness mind. And that second quality of mindfulness on just an ordinary level means that certain commitment to sitting practice, on a regular basis, sitting practice on a regular basis. And the third of these three qualities is prajna, which in this case means knowledge, study, understanding. And there's a great respect for learning in Buddhism and for scholarship. And there's literally gazillions of books now translated into English. And you could never in, multiple lifetimes even make a dent in how many things you could read if you were so inclined, which is very interesting in terms of the history of the Dharma in the West. When I first started studying the Dharma, there were like 4 or 5 books in English that everybody read. And you could say, oh, did you read this? and you could cover the entire canon because that was just whatever random books had to be translated at the time. Now there's an abundance of richness. And the written word, limited as it is, words are very limited, still are incredibly skillful means. So, for instance, on the shrine, the highest thing on this kind of shrine is not like an image, it is a book. Books are revered. They're never put on the floor. You don't step over them. They're held in reverence, books. And the sharpening. So the quality of intellect is a clarity and sharpening. The quality of samadhi is a stillness, and as in the movie that Vijayadara called hard peace, and Shila is a kind of quality of restraint, doing no harm. That's a fundamental kind of challenge, doing no harm. And we harm ourselves and we harm others in so many ways, but mostly from being mindless. And I wanted to touch on 2 more things. Sorry, this is a little longer. My other talk will be much shorter, I promise. but these are important, and they run through the whole thing. One of them is as Vidyadhara says in the very first chapter, the very beginning of the book, he says the Hinayana is characterized by absence of frivolity. Absence of frivolity. So one might think, well, what's that? Frivolity. What does it mean to be frivolous? And I'd like to leave that to you to think about. Because absence of frivolity, not the same as kind of just suddenly everybody's uptight all the time about everything you do. That wouldn't be very good. But what is the kind of fruit of frivolity? You know, what does it support? What does it lead to? Why do you think it's a big deal? I'll leave that as a question. And finally, the Vidyadhara in presenting the Dharma all along, and maybe particularly emphasizing it in the times that he was introduced in the Western world, made a big deal about what he called non-theism. Non-theism. And that has several levels of meaning. It's not simply kind of saying nasty things about traditions like Hinduism or Christianity or Judaism. That's not the main point, you know. But there was, again, going back to this ground of personal liberation, individual liberation, I think there are two components that were primary in this non-theistic view. The first is that not giving up the looking for an external savior, passing the buck, so to speak, with your own issues, or you know, like in a play, you know, the Deus Ex Machina that's going to come in and like lift away all your obstacles and say, good girl, good boy, you're great, we love you, we love you, I'll take care of everything. The big mommy or poppy in the sky. He said, well, give that up, you know. I think I've known some really brilliant Christian teachers who would say similar things to their, you know, disciples, whatever. But it's sort of that kind of being babies. I think grow up, you know. It's not going to happen. If you're waiting for it to happen, good luck to you. So he said, give that up. Come right back. What is your immediate situation? Deal with that, and don't expect help. Don't expect help that someone's going to save you in any way. I think another aspect, why he emphasized it so much at that time, was he considered and said many times that one of the major obstacles to making progress on the path was becoming overly religious. Religiosity, and all the trappings that come along with that religiosity of that kind of preciousness and the feeling superiority and then becoming very attached to your tradition and then, you know, goes on and on until eventually, you know, everybody's killing each other off. You know, that's what religiosity eventually ends up being. And it's not genuine. It's like a pretentious quality to religiosity, and I think he felt that people could fall prey to that because of exoticism and you know, the colorfulness, and then, you know, saying, isn't that cool? Now I'm a this, I'm a that, wear a special hat or something, or doing a secret handshake, and maybe feels really special. And I think he was really trying to relax that quality, and it's a quality that's very deep within us, our ideas of what we're supposed to be like, you know, especially in a spiritual path. I'm supposed to be, you know, peaceful all the time, I'm supposed to be nice, I'm supposed to, you know, I'm supposed to look a certain way, I'm this and that, and all those ideas are just like it's like a jungle, you need a machete to get through them, and then, you know, finally you'll end up just simply who you are as you are, and then you say, okay, ground zero. That's the Hinayana, ground zero. Come back to that, and that's an incredibly fruitful place to begin. The end. So we have a few minutes for comments or questions or whatnot. Robbie?
Thank you, Judy. You said in his non-theistic approach there were two components. One was giving up, looking for an external deity. Mm-hmm. And the second was?
Religiosity.
Oh, okay, I see. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the wonderful news that we're in charge of our own prison. It's liberating and disturbing at the same time. I wondered if you could say something about that a little bit further, because as we all know, in this relative world that we live in, there are definitely situations where our imprisonment is well outside of ourselves. Nelson Mandela came to mind, actually, and So how do you relate those two things, that on one hand we really are the orchestrators of our own suffering at the same time as that we live in a world where that's being perpetuated for many different reasons?
Excellent. Thank you for that. It's true. There's a lot of literal people in literal prisons all over the world and in situations not of their own immediate making under which they're suffering. People in war zones, people in prison, people oppressed in various ways, economically, socially, etc. And this is not saying that those don't, real prisons don't matter, but it's saying as an individual practitioner, there's a situation you're in and there's your response to it, right? And you can't always change the situation you are in, but you take prisoner A and prisoner B, you know, how what they deal with that, or oppressed person A and oppressed person B, there's different responses. Some can be much more effective in healing, and some can contribute, add to your outside prison, to your inside prison, make a double walls. There's a traditional image of someone trying to deal with the rough spots in life. You know, the world being filled with like thorns and sharp rocks and lava fields and whatnot. And the traditional image is, well, what are you going to do about that? And one was, well, let's try to cover the whole earth with leather so it's nice and smooth and you never stub your toe. And then someone else said, well, it's more effective. Why don't you build shoes? And then there's still going to be those bad situations because that's the nature of samsara. There's a lot of suffering in this world. Right? And when you study later, we'll talk more about, we'll talk about the Four Noble Truths, etc. And there's the, they make a clear division between the kind of, you know, social and political suffering that you're mentioning and your own personal suffering. And there's different things to do about each, you know. But recognizing, it's sort of like the AA thing, we're recognizing, it's that serenity prayer, you know, recognize things you can change, things you can't change, you know. And being clear about that, and then working on what you can do for yourself and for others, yeah. So you don't go crazy. No, because there's endless problems.
Boy, I could say a few things, but I'll limit myself to one. So it's just kind of interesting. On my way here, I stayed with my mother, who has recently remarried a man who is Christian, and he's very devout Christian, and now she has rediscovered her religion and Christianity. And so I tend to try to avoid conversations with them because I don't want to get into a big debate, you know. But I was kind of explaining to them what this path was all about. And it was so interesting because they both I guess I had low expectations, but they both zeroed in on just what we're talking about. Her husband said, oh, so the difference between Christianity and Buddhism is in Christianity, we look externally for our salvation. And in Buddhism, we're looking internally. So, I mean, to me, he kind of nailed that point just like that. And then it was kind of my mother's response to that was, oh, that sounds really hard, though, to look at yourself, you know, and she was very honest. She says, I need that. I need that someone external. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I thought that was, especially given my mother, and that's another story, but that showed a lot of awareness on her part, that at least she was honest and just said that. So I just thought I'd share that. Very relevant.
And, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, we all long for that. We all long for someone to take care of us and, you know, to make it all go away. Don't we? I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't long for that. That sounds good to me. So she's really right on in recognizing that. It's not different than us. And that's the other thing about the non-theism. It gets down to the very personal level. It's not about, you know, one religion versus another so much. And some of the Buddhists can be the most theistic of all. Some of us, you know.
I just wanted to follow up Diane's comment because that is often the image that Buddhism is this very difficult thing looking inward, and it would be nice to have this outer salvation. And so what comes to mind is just that the Vidyadhara would often say, you don't have to go out and create difficulties. You don't have to go out and look for things to make it hard. You know, and that the point over and over again was just to wake up to our own obstacles and restrictions. And not to kind of make it into a hardship case. And
so when you were making this point, you said something about, you know, no one is going to help you. And I've been thinking about that ever since you said that, the notion of help. And I was thinking this way and that way about it. But it relates to what you were saying about that if the student is open, there's many things you can recognize as wisdom, a personal teacher or even there's this TV show that I'm getting addicted to, which I think is very wise. It
Which one?
It's called Call the Midwife. Speaking of help, it's called Call the Midwife, and it's very, it's on, I really recommend it. It's on PBS. And it's so raw. I mean, it's all about birth and death, and I mean, it's very raw, and I'm just impressed that there's no sugary overlay, and it's very moving, and it's a teaching vehicle. So in the notion of help, I guess help is your responsibility as well, I guess from that point of view. It's like, and also there's discrimination involved. There's this kind of help that you just want sort of something to come and solve all your problems, but there's actual help out there if you can connect with it. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where I came to. I don't know if you want to comment further on that.
That was well said.
Okay.